The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Market stage, a comeback for the week. Missiles fired on Syria in a symbolic hand slap. The Fed is a bit more hawkish in their latest FOMC minutes, and our guest today is Eddie Elfenbein from Crossing Wall Street. All this and much more on episode number 556 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, happy tax day to everybody that is planning on filing their taxes over the next couple of days. Anyway, this is Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me this week, every week, as we talk about all things related to money and markets and finance and your security in terms of your overall net worth and wealth. Bring on some great guests. Sometimes we have a bit of a discussion about economics, sometimes just about the market, sometimes just about theory and education. So hopefully you're getting what you need out of this show. And hopefully, if that is the case, I would ask you to do me a favor and retweet this show. Go on Twitter, follow me at Andrew Horowitz, and retweet it. Send it out there. You'll see the link. You'll see the announcement. Go over to my stream. You'll see that we have always pop the link of each show on there, and then send it out to everybody that you know as well. Also, tell your friends and family. Get them to sign up on iTunes or on an app that hosts podcasts. So great way to spread the word, and that's the way that you can, if in a way, say thank you. I always say thank you to you for the great questions you have and the information you bring. The friendship kind of works both ways. So if you can, that would be great. Well, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the markets over the last week. We saw that we had another seesaw session and another one and another one. And we finished with, well, one more. It was one of those weeks that, again, headlines seemed to really take center stage, where there was, you know what last week seemed like? It was almost like everybody was waiting for, all right, when's today's news going to drop? It's going to freak everybody out. I was waiting, seriously, I was waiting every day for something to come out and wonder, all right, how are markets going to take this? What do we do? Is there going to be an opportunity to buy something? Should we short into it? Should we hedge? What are we doing here? Every day. And this has been going on for some time. But last week, it reached a crescendo because we knew that there was some discussion about the potential for some kind of military action in response to the chemical warfare and chemical killings and this horrible situation that was developing in Syria. And there was a notification that, yeah, something is coming. And we thought this on Wednesday and Thursday. But I realized, you know, if we don't do anything by Thursday, the reality is that probably nothing's going to happen until at least the weekend. And the reason for that is that we know this administration and Congress and politicians generally do not want to disrupt markets. They're very, this administration in particular, very focused on markets, and that's a good thing. We like that. But the problem is that you realize that at the same time, they have to be very careful with some of the things that they do. And one of those things is any kind of significant move that may be very disruptive and concerning to markets. So they waited till when? You think this was a coincidence, by the way? They waited till right after the futures markets closed on Friday to launch the attack. The news came out after that. Why? You do it as close as you can towards the close. It's kind of like the Friday night dump that we see when companies come out with all sorts of 10Ks or refilings or footnoted letters and outlooks on a Friday night and hoping that nobody sees it. It's hidden. It works. It does work because most people will go home. Traders will go home and say, well, everything's done. And they don't see it because it gets all lopped into the weekend information. And that's what happened here. What happened was that we in my opinion, at least, did a pretty much symbolic hand slap saying, hey, we're going to hit a couple of, we're going to give you, first of all, fair warning, and then we're going to hit a couple of areas that were supposed to be related to chemical warfare and where you're holding these things. And therefore, we're going to prove the point with the allies that we will not stand for this. And they did so again right after the futures closed on Friday night. And that pretty much dissipated throughout the weekend to a point because if you think about it, what happened was we claimed victory. We said we're pretty much not going to do anything more unless they do more. And therefore, the whole situation is diffused. Rather than anybody thinking that we're going to go into a full military offensive on this, we are just pretty much stopping here. And therefore, Marcus will pretty much say, hey, all right, nothing to worry about. Let's get it on. I saw a lot of people on Twitter wondering, oh, are we going to see a crash and a, you know, into the week after, you know, after the weekend, and the market's going to open and what's going to happen? And I'm thinking, I don't know why there would be any kind of downtrend or downstroke on the open, because it seems like we're done. At least that's what's being telegraphed by everything that I've read over the weekend. So is there a green light? Well, that's one more thing that can be crossed off the list as a concerning factor that at least right now, at the moment, we're pretty much done with that. This big war that everybody was worried about throughout the whole week lasted 5 minutes, and that's it. Done. Done in a way and telegraphed in a way that the administration knew that markets would say, oh, they're doing this after the close. They're very aware of market conditions. They're very concerned about that. Therefore, they're going to contain it. And markets can then say, and investors then can believe that they have our back. They're making sure that we don't get too concerned. So I'd venture to say that going into the next week, some of the selling that we saw on Friday into the close will be bought up, and we'll see a move back to the upside with the idea that this is, at least for now, the end of this whole Syrian conflict. Kind of funny, actually, if you think about it. But that's how it is. That's how it works. Now, inflation last week also was a major issue. We saw the Federal Open Market Committee come out with their minutes for the last meeting. They were a bit more hawkish in their commentary. There's no question about that. They did seem that they were very concerned about some of the impact of the taxes and the spending and the deregulation with regard to inflation and the inflationary pressures that this could add. And also, of course, that goes without saying, related to growth, that there will be some opportunity for higher wages and maybe growth and better sales. And this may, in fact, have to, it may require a quicker rate hike process. That's at least what they were giving off in their commentary. However, we did see inflation come in a little bit less than expected. The PPI still came in hotter, the wholesale inflation number, and bond yields did move up. So there is, I think the markets do believe that the Fed will continue on a slow path here. That also caused a little bit of overhead resistance when we look at this in its entirety of what the sentiment was last week. But again, that's another thing crossed off once we saw that inflation was not still continuing higher. Came in as, I think, 0.1%. We also saw a few bank earnings. The start of earnings season came out. And on Friday, we saw Citi and JP, Wells Fargo. And when their numbers came out and they beat on the top line and the bottom line, there was a lot of euphoria. Pre-markets, the stocks were up 2 to 3%. Everybody was happy. And then something must have happened during that conference call that investors didn't like. And from what I could see, it was pretty much about their outlook. There was a contained outlook. You would have thought that with interest rate yields talked about by everybody as, oh, this is really good for the banks as the interest rate rises, and the thought about deregulation, that it would be really good long-term. People were bidding up banks for a while, and then all of a sudden starts to slow down because the realization was that this could be, well, at least short-lived. And they did get a really good benefit, but they pulled that forward in their last quarter. They did a whole bunch of things to pull forward the tax benefits last quarter. And their outlook again was quite concerning. Some of it was about the tariffs, the potential for further deregulation in the face of a Congress that just can't get anything done. Trading fees also continuing to be a bit better, but still nothing to get too excited about. But this outlook was concerning. Now, here's what's happening. So we have earnings season started. More earnings are on the way. We have a lot of things happening next week and the next week after that, particularly tech earnings coming up the following week. But I'm going to be very closely paying attention to this whole idea of what is the outlook. Okay, fine. You beat on the top line, you beat on the bottom line, hopefully, and you did it with a margin above the whisper. That's okay. What is the outlook here? Are we going to see a reflection of the good news where many of these companies are going to benefit long-term from the lower tax rate, from the continuation of a continuation of global growth? Is this all going to play into it, or is there going to be a lot more emphasis put on some of the geopolitical headwinds, the tariffs, the Brexit, the Feds, and the central banks around the world starting to slow down their rate of stimulus? I mean, what are we actually going to see here? And that, I think, is going to allow us to get a better sense of why markets have been so volatile. But this is a big issue here, this outlook, because one of the things we noticed this quarter, different than many of the quarters in the past, was that analysts have been raising their estimates right up into the number. Historically, what you usually see is that analysts are really rosy. They're excited. Hey, you know what? A year from now, we think the company's going to earn this amount. And they usually raise that level. They raise their price targets. And then a few months into, before the quarterly comes out, they start to slow down and maybe adjust that and bring down their estimates. Why? It's very simple. Because if they bring down their estimates to a point that they believe companies can beat, well, then we're going to have this great number of 70% of companies beat on their earnings and about 60% or so beat on their revenues. And therefore, everybody's happy, happy. Now, this time, they're starting to raise their levels. They're raising their earnings estimations for many of these companies. And you wonder if that's a little bit too, they're a little bit too excited. So that's going to be something we're going to have to watch if that is going to create further volatility, further concern, because companies are coming out with, if they come out with, more of a downbeat outlook. But again, we only saw a few companies, so we're not going to say this is the trend at this point. It's just something to keep an eye of. The last thing we're going to talk about before we get to our guest, I want to talk just a couple of items here. I want to thank everybody for the recent reviews. If you haven't done so already, it's really important that we understand your feedback, your thoughts, your general comments, what could we do better, what we are really good at, whatever it is. If you go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, there's a little thing that says podcast reviews. Click on that, drops down and says submit a review, and please submit a review. You can read the other reviews as well, but please submit a review of the podcast. It'd mean a lot to me. I really appreciate that. So you could do that very easily. And I mentioned also that the Horowitz Company quarterly commentary is available. We'll put on the show notes for episode 556. The way to get that and download that, you can go over there and just grab it. Talk about a couple of really important items, particularly about, I'll focus on the idea of tariffs and what that means. And finally, there is a little information piece on the right side of the site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, where I'm going to be in New York at the Benzinga FinTech Awards. We're going to actually be doing the DH Unplugged podcast live on Tuesday night from New York. And we're also going to be doing some great interviews there with some really wonderful people. So if you are interested in getting together in New York, make sure you tell me and we'll see if we can figure something out there. Finally, some great guests coming up. We got Howard Lindzen, Tim Seymour, we got Jason Raznick, Daniel Crosby. Really put together a great list over the next few weeks. So make sure to stay tuned in to the show. Well, how about we get to another great guest? Why don't we? And new to this episode, welcome a new guest, first timer, Eddie Elfenbein, and he's a Washington, D.C. based speaker, portfolio manager, and editor of the blog Crossing Wall Street. And he has something called a buy list, which we're going to get into. But first, hey, Eddie, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me. Let me tell you how I found you. First of all, I found you on Twitter, and I kind of came for the comedy. You're a funny guy.
Thanks.
And I stayed for the insights, just to let you know. So there's some good stuff in there that that I found, and it's great. What's really interesting also is that it's refreshing to this may sound negative at first, but it's not. It's refreshing to see someone who actually writes the old style blog concept, right? The daily kind of updates or the weekly updates that's all free, and it's kind of blog style versus these days everybody seems to have gotten away from that in the investment world.
Yeah, our attention spans get shorter and shorter. Maybe it's just the Twitter. We're just limited to some characters. But there's sometimes you have more of a thought that you want to express, and that's what a blog is great for.
Yeah, I mean more of a thought, more than a headline you'd like to express, right?
So exactly.
You have to capture some of these people's their thoughts in a headline. And actually, the media knows all about that. And they know and try to grab you in there with next great stock to crash. Check this out. But all right, let's get started. Talk about some things, because I think that a lot of my listeners will be interested to find out a bit about, how you got started with what you were doing, because it was kind of interesting. I mean, you start out basically, back in 2006, writing this. What was the whole, why did you start writing Crossing Wall Street? Why did you start getting involved? And how long have you been investing? Give me a little background.
Sure. Let me see. I mean, I guess I've been in professional investing for about 25 years now. I guess I got my MBA from UConn in 94. After that, I worked as a cold caller at the, sort of bottom of the street. And then I worked as a sales assistant, kind of bounced around. And then I got with a research firm, a company that published newsletters. So I worked with them for a number of years. And then I went into the consulting game. And then the middle of 2005, I decided to launch the blog. And I saw a lot of these blogs grow up, especially after maybe 9/11, that these blogs really started to take over in the political world. But I really didn't see much in the financial world. And I felt like I really had something to say. And I was working with, companies mailing out newsletters at this time. And I thought, we really had to move into the new world. I guess the person I really read at the time was Barry Ritholtz. And he had a great blog, very incisive, and really had something to say about the market and the economy. So it was the middle of 2005. I launched Crossing Wall Street, and I just had something to say. And you're surprised how quickly you post something, it gets passed around through emails. People say, "Hey, check this out." And within a while, I got invited onto CNBC, and people wanted to hear my comments. It's something I never could have done just through the regular channels, so I wasn't working for a big firm at that time. So it really was pretty fascinating the way, I can get my views out there. I also enjoy writing. So it really was just a great experience, and also just put me in contact with a lot of great people. And I learned a lot from readers and other bloggers.
Right. It's interesting because we have a similar history. I think we started the podcast back in 2007. And also doing some blogging back there and writing. There was a lot to write about back then, in terms of, things that were really hitting the tape. And actually, Barry Ritholtz was one of our first guests. I like to say I got him started in the whole podcasting thing. when he started on our podcast, he didn't even know what a podcast was. And it was kind of an interesting, he's been on several different times, but good guy. But so now you also started to evolve into, doing some, or actually publishing your buy list, which is, something you've done. It's actually, which is also refreshing back to the original blog concept. It's all free. I mean, it's not like somebody has to, pay you for it, to find your buy list. So let's kind of go over your key strategies. And again, I think this is important for a lot of our listeners because there's so many different strategies in this whole momentum investing idea of just kind of getting in for, a period based on some technicals, are important for a lot of people, but you're more of a fundamental kind of a bottoms up stock picker, right?
Yeah, I sort of see myself as an old-fashioned stock picker, old-fashioned gunslinger. I just I'm not it's no macroeconomics, no something super fancy. I'm just trying to pick good stocks at good prices. And like you said, so I started blogging in 2005. I had kind of a mini buy list in late 2005. And then in 2006, I decided to formalize it. So I chose at the beginning of each year, I said, here are 20 stocks, and I'm just going to track them. I'm not going to make any changes for the entire year, just these 20 stocks. And I wanted to say, to show investors, you can beat the market. You can do it. You get good stocks. You don't trade too much. You focus on high quality. You don't get rattled out of them when the market swoons like so many people do. And I wanted to show that, yeah, you can beat the indexes. You don't have to be satisfied with an index fund. So I've been doing the buy list. I guess it's our 13th year now that we've been doing it. Only changes, we expanded it from 20 to 25 stocks.
But now what happens, you mentioned this, that – well, people kind of, buy stocks and they can get blown out because of market moves. But so if you have a list of stocks that you hold for a year, let's say in theory, are there things that will come into play that will say, oh, there's a change in the character, the fundamentals, something with that stock, right? Because obviously things change. Let's look at, for example, let's look at GE for a second, right? GE, maybe not now, maybe not last year, but I mean, it had good fundamentals for a long period of time. Something changed dramatically and that was a little bit of a longer term kind of situation. But what would say, hey, you know what? Here's the buy list. We'll hold it for a year. But is there anything that comes into play that says, well, this stock, this change of management, or they change their business, or something's different? Let's stay away from this one.
Yeah, absolutely. These things happen. I mean, companies are dynamic organizations. A very good example I have on a buy list, similar to GE, is the story of Bed Bath & Beyond. The financials, ROE, operating margins, they were outstanding for years and years and years. And the company just over the last few years has fallen apart. And they're really, really difficult times lately. So, in many ways, very, very similar to GE. So people always say, would you always hold it for the entire year? You don't make any changes during the year? And the answer is no, I don't. And this is the reason why. Even if you do spot the troubles like you see at GE, you see these problems with management coming in, there's still the issue of when to get out. And people are very, very bad about timing on when to get out. That's why I like the business first approach of saying we make these decisions just once a year. We totally neutralize that. And I see it as a benefit. It's not just sort of a rule we use. It's an actual benefit for us because it fights our behavioral biases. We talked about Barry. Barry talks about that all the time. You're in investing, your brain works against itself. So I think having these mechanistic rules to follow, it's a benefit. I think in the long run, it helps us just to say, once a year we make this change, that's the only time, because it forces us each year to totally dress down the stock and look at it completely. And then we have to say, are we still comfortable holding this for another 12 months? 12 months, it's locked and sealed. So it makes us extra, more vigilant about what we do.
So what are some of your favorite metrics? I mean, again, I'm just going to kind of give the other side of the discussion. A lot of times we talk about technical analysis with a lot of people that come on. We talk about, various moving averages. Some people talk about indicators. Some people talk about, volume and prices. That's the whole pricing structure. Fundamentals have an entirely different vernacular. What are some of the things that you are, that you really like and that you really need to put into your research?
Sure. Now, this is a good example. This is a subtle point. It's hard to convey. It's good I can do this on a podcast to sort of explain this point. So many people want to know kind of what's the formula? What do you follow? What do you do? And I don't follow a specific formula. With fundamental investing, all the numbers, all the ratios, all this huge metrics we have, that only tells us is how good is this company? That's what it tells us. So I want to get behind that and find out what is a good company? Why is this a good company? So does it have a strong market position? Does it have a well-established brand? Does it have good management? Those are the things that are reflected in the numbers. You don't want to look at the numbers first. You want to look at the characteristics which the numbers reflect. So with that, I like to see a good ROE. I like to see consistent operating histories, steadily rising sales, steadily rising earnings. I love to see companies that raise their dividend every year. I love to see companies that give guidance. Not all companies are required to do that. Love to see companies that do that. Particularly, I like expanding operating margins. That's something very good to see. Also, low debt, another thing always good to see. You know, it always comes back to Warren Buffett's idea of a moat. I want to see a company that if they needed to, they can raise their prices without too much harm. Moody's is an excellent company like that. So the thing is, I don't look at the numbers. I don't look at the metrics. I look at the things that cause the metrics to be good. A lot of people confuse those two.
It's interesting because, like you said, I mean, it there's a lot of let's get something straight. There's a lot of fine companies out there, a lot of good mm-hmm. managers, a lot of very good opportunity to find solid fundamentals. And of course, there's that one caveat that I think at least is that there are a lot of companies, or I wouldn't say a lot, there are companies that can really look good on the inside, but are really kind of questionable how they really put this all together. You know, they can do a great job. They hire the best accountants and financial folks that will put together what looks good for everybody. But in fact, something stinks to high hell. You know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely. Yes.
So we got to be careful of that. So you rebalance on a yearly basis. And do you...
It's five stocks of the portfolio. So what I've, 20% turnover.
What does that mean?
So I swap in five and I take out five of the 20.
Every year?
That's right.
So you may have a stock in there. I'm just picking a time frame for 5 years.
Absolutely. So that's sort of what I aim for as the average.
Right. So you have this core grouping here. The other thing is that with the 25 names, so just to kind of look at it in a snapshot version, do you, so I'm a guy that's looking to put together a portfolio and I'm thinking, okay, what do I do? Where do I research? And all right, I got these 25 names. These are names that I like. This is your situation. Do I buy all of them? Do I wait for a particular price? What do I do here?
Yeah. Now, I have on the blog, I list a buy below price. Now, you don't have to be a good investor, to have a solid portfolio, you don't need to buy all 25. I would say at the minimum, if you are well diversified, eight stocks is plenty diversified. Again, you want to make sure, so many investors think, I'm diversified. I have Google and Apple. No, right. That's not diversified. Right. You want to have a bank. You want to have a drug company. You want to have a tech. You want to have a transport. So, broadly, so you can have 20 stocks and be not diversified. You can have eight and be pretty well diversified. So I see eight as kind of the low end. Always, I think the more you own, the better. And then if you want to have a very well diversified, there is a way starting in 2016 where you can buy instantly the entire buy list in one simple package.
Oh, how's that? do tell.
we started, I worked with great partners at Advisor Shares, and we launched an ETF based on the buy list. And I've never had this before. I had to choose a stock symbol. Interesting thing in my life. I never chose a stock symbol. So the blog is Crossing Wall Street, and we were able to get, it was open, CWS. So we grabbed that as the ticker symbol. And I say, if the Chicago White Sox ever decide to go public, I am willing to sell that to them.
Very smart of you. This was a plan. Yeah. I see how this was all planned out so well. I see that. So the other thing is that I find interesting is in terms of at least your buy list, and I don't know about your personal investing, but you never go short.
No.
Why is that?
like I said, I'm an old-fashioned stock picker. I get them for long. Now, I see plenty of lousy stocks out there. This is the problem I have with shorting. Shorting is about timing.
Oh, yeah.
I'll give you a perfect example is look at the financial crisis. So many people said it was a bubble. This was not new. So many people called it a bubble, and they were way early on that trade because the bubble just got bigger and bigger. I remember people in 2004 and 2005 saying all the things that did come to pass, but it held out longer and longer than you thought possible. It's always interesting. Like, nobody thought it was a bubble. So many people thought it was a bubble, but it's getting that timing right. And I admit up front, I can't do that.
Right.
I can spot bad stocks, but I can't get the time.
It either is timing, or it's the ability to hold on to your. It's the same. Listen, it's the same thing as when a stock falls from grace. So let's say a stock is at $50, and you believe in the stock for whatever reason. You know, this is a good stock. You like this stock, and you're willing to buy it, and you put your money in at $50. Now it's at 40. Now it's at 30. Now it's at 25. You're like, oh, you know, I don't see anything different here. Maybe it's a market-related issue. I'm not sure what's going on here. I'm willing to buy. People are much more apt to buy down, right? You know, that continue to add on. Now, whether or not that works out, it's a different discussion. But their holding period for that is a long period of time. When it comes to shorting, the fear is, oh, my God, it's going to go up forever.
Right.
It's never going to come down. So it's all about the time frame that you deal with shorting that really can clarify whether or not this is something to do. For example, you look at stocks like a GoPro. When GoPro came out, I was like, now this is interesting. I like it. It's great. And then I started thinking, oh man, this is a disaster in the making. This is a camera. It's a freaking camera. You know, it's a great camera. I got two of them, by the way, but I've never replaced them because they do what they're supposed to do. And I said, you know, on top of that, to trying to do the social media thing and all this. And after everybody gets, you know, their one GoPro, what do they need more than that? You know, it's not like a great brand like Nike that you know the rubber is going to wear out of the bottom of the shoe eventually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, okay, you got to buy another shoe eventually, right? Or the new style or something like that. But anyway, it went up, came down a bit, kind of spiked up again. So
it did.
So the problem was that if you were short this, you know, you could probably be shaken out of it unless you were absolute about it. And then you would have been a hero in the end. Well, hero, no pun intended. That's the name of their camera, actually, the GoPro Hero. But nonetheless, it is, I understand the reluctance to do so. And I'll tell you something else and tell me what you think about this. If your mindset is that you're going to find great companies, if this is what you're doing, you're going to find great companies, you're going to invest in them at all. Going short can be very distracting, right? Because now all of a sudden you got to look at both sides of the equation. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should find the bad stocks. I think it'll go down. And then you got to research that. And it takes you off of, then what happens is it starts to bleed into the long side of the equation. And I can see where that can become something difficult, but let's go to the next point I want to ask you about.
So if I could just also add, remember, you can also have somebody comes out and wants to do a dumb acquisition,
right?
Totally blows out your trade.
Right.
What about some bank decides to upgrade it? Totally blows out your trade.
Right.
So you're really dependent on that much more than you are with other trades. The history of lousy M&A is a very long and rich one.
Yeah, not to mention the rumor mill that talks about that there's a potential acquisition that doesn't happen. The stock spikes 20% in one day.
Exactly.
You know. So looking back over the time that you've been doing this, from the days when you were cold calling, newsletters, research, all the way through developing your own ETF. So what would you have done differently? What have you changed in your process to learn more about, you know, markets and stocks? I'm really talking to and framing this for the listener who's kind of like starting out looking to how to, you know, what to do, what to avoid, the pitfalls, the traps and all that.
Sure. Now, for me, I guess the big thing that I've learned again and again is I am very wary of what I would call the top down, which unfortunately I think dominates the discussion people have about the stock market. People want to talk about Donald Trump. People want to talk about the Federal Reserve. People want to talk about macroeconomics. And I really see that as a limiting discussion. It's not that it's not true, it's just very limiting, where I see it as being a bottom up and finding out the companies and digging into them and getting away from the meta narrative, the investing at 30,000 feet. That is such a big deal, and people just don't get that. It's always amazing to me that you find these great companies and nobody really wants to talk about what's going on at the company. People, they want to talk about, you know, on CNBC and Bloomberg, all these media outlets, you can find tons of information on about 10 to 15 stocks. You know what's going to be in the news, but there's this huge area of stocks getting about what's their product, what are their finances, how does the next quarter look? People really just aren't interested in that.
Well, you know, the other problem is that a lot of the information about their earnings, when you're doing a true straight up bottoms up analysis, comes out once a quarter. There may be some interim releases here and there. So what else are you going to do to fill your time, for goodness sakes? Right? You know what I mean? You got to find something.
That's exactly right. And you know, it's the daily soap opera of you know, what's going on Tesla. You know, I was invited on CNBC. They have their trade. I don't know why they invited me on the Traders Nation. And for several times, they asked me about Tesla. And I mean, that's what they were asking every time. Obviously, people are interested in it. They think it's a fascinating company. But there's thousands of other companies out there. I'll just give you one example. One of the best investments we ever made in the buy list was a tiny company called Nicholas Financial. They made auto loans for used cars. The stock dropped. I mean, it was pennies on the dollar. The book value, I think, was like 0.3. It was during the financial crisis. There was no information. I called the company. I talked to the CFO. It happened many times. You know, it's not followed by any Wall Street company. We made a huge amount of money. But people, they just want to talk about Republicans and Democrats, the Federal Reserve, what's going on with the economy, and they're just overlooked where you can find great stocks.
So let me ask you this then. What do you think about Tesla? and in fairness and in full disclosure, we are currently short Tesla, just as a point of reference for our clients.
I don't think that's an unwise move.
Yeah. I mean, I think with this one in particular, you gotta be, you know, he comes out with things out of left field, like yesterday or today or the last week, it was a couple of days ago, I think it was. He comes, oh, we're going to be cash flow positive in quarter three and four or something like that. You know, this tweet out there. Why? Well, because he's got 700 other things that are going against him right now. And there's a real big concern there. But anyway, so what do you think? We talked about some of this. We talked about how people can really focus on the fundamentals. And just to clarify for you, because I don't know if you know this, I like all of it. I look at the fundamentals. That's the base way that we pull up our positions for a strategy that we have, where we are looking at you know, real good growth. And as you mentioned, we want high ROEs. We want to see margin expansion. We want to see all these things kind of fitting together before we put a stock in the portfolio. But at the same time, I mean, I think, you know, and I've been around for a while doing this, I think some of the economics do help to understand a little bit about the bigger picture, just to kind of set the backdrop, you know, just to understand what's happening out there. You can have the best stock in the world in a really crappy economic environment. Things may not go well. I'm just saying, you know, from that. Again, different than what you're doing. And then technicals, I also like that to look at, you know, where pricing and buy points are, just as a point of reference. But what can people do to be better investors? You said that, you know, a lot of people get caught up in the minutia and the news and the daily things and all that. But what is the first thing that somebody could do to become a better investor?
The biggest thing is, to coin a phrase, to be disciplined about this.
Oh, yeah, good. The discipline. I like it. Yeah, that's good. Perfect.
And it really, it is absolutely true, is to set the expectations of what you want, understanding that it's a process. Owning a stock, placing investment is, you know, you want to have a reasonable time horizon on this. This is something that it's not going to explode for you overnight, or if it, you know, just because you buy a stock and it goes down, that doesn't mean you're wrong. Those things, that there's a natural volatility. This is the example I give to people. The long run of the market, each day the stock market gains on average about 1/30% every day. Pretty tiny. So $30 stock means a penny a day. The average daily swing is about 1% every day. So that means that 29/30 is complete noise. It's absolute nonsense. It's just, you know, the wind tossing things. So investors need to understand that is, you know, this is the business we've chosen, as they say in The Godfather, that this is, you know, just how the market works. So it's important for investors to understand that. And also, I would say investing is business, and it should be treated that way. This is how you go about it. It's a serious thing. Understanding that the businesses, the stocks you invest in, are ongoing companies. They're not lottery tickets. They're real organizations that make a profit or a loss and have products, have employees, and have customers. Understanding that's what it's about.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, as opposed to Bitcoin.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, the opposite side of this discussion. Do you have a favorite theme moving forward?
My favorite theme going forward?
Yeah. I mean, just generally speaking, just, you know, I don't know. I know you don't really deal with the thematics as much, but I'm just asking.
Yeah. I really don't have a strong theme about going. There are areas interested. I don't have real payoffs for this, but I think things like, you know, computer security, obviously, I think that's going to be a growing field in the coming years. All the problems that we see, if somebody has, you know, easier ways to fix the problems that we're seeing right now. And I guess in the intermediate term, more of I think a lot of cyclical, I think that's going to be growing over the next few years, is, you know, cyclical stocks at this point in the cycle. Mm-hmm. But generally, I wouldn't call myself a thematic investor.
Right. So over the last 10 years, here's something I want to ask you, because I think it's kind of interesting if you're looking back on this. How have the dynamics of the market and of picking stocks and of, you know, kind of what's happening in the investment environment changed over the last 10 years?
That is a really good question. This is how I would answer it. I say we have this overflow, almost superabundance of news, superabundance of information, but not news. People are giving you all this number, all this data, but few people are saying this is what to do. I suspect that this has placed a greater premium on your time horizon and a less premium on news. You know, the famous story of the Rothschilds using the bird to fly back from the Battle of Waterloo to get the advantage, that kind of stuff with the Bloomberg terminals, all the, you know, democratization of numbers. I think that premium has fallen dramatically. And just being a patient investor, I think there's an increased premium on that. That has a big change. That wasn't so much true 10, 15 years ago.
So one thing I want to also ask you about, because I know you're in the ETF space with your Crossing Wall Street CWS symbol, and it is
available at, you know, major
bookstores everywhere.
Yeah.
It's the Eddy index, but aside from that, it's not a true index, right? It's an actively managed, maybe not changed all the time, but it's actively managed, I would call it, versus an index ETF. Would you agree with that?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. What are your feelings on, and take your I have an actively managed fund hat off for 1 second. Okay. What is your thoughts on the indexing craze that has gone on and the impact on markets?
Sure. Here's the thing: is I'm not anti-indexing at all. For some people, they want to do with it. It's a sound strategy. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with it. It shows, you know, over long term, it beats a lot of people in my camp. So I see it as kind of a, you know, different strokes for different folks, people. As long as people understand what the index is and what it's about, it's a perfectly fine strategy. My feeling is that there are strategies that have beaten the market over the long term. And I would rather go down swinging, trying, than to accept that. It's just, you know, it's how it is. Now, I'll give you an example, is that the ETF was profiled in Barron's a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And the writer said, well, you know, he charges a lot more. You can get an index fund that charges, you know, 6 basis points or whatever the hell. And that's exactly true. But he's sort of missing the point. It's like, as I see it, it's like going up to a person who collects classic cars and likes to build classic cars and say to them, you know, the gas mileage on this old Corvette, that's nothing compared to a Prius. It's like, yeah, we know, we get it, we understand that, but that's not what we're about. We're stock pickers. We're trying to beat the market. This is what we do. So I just see it as two camps. Now, the other question is, what kind of effect does this have on the market? Is this changing how the market is? I'm kind of a doubter on that front. I've heard people say that, you know, this could cause selling cascades. You know, despite the enormous growth of indexing, I don't see it having a negative, worrisome effect on the market. As long as investors understand what they're getting into and, you know, what the parameters are of their investment, I don't see it as anything big deal. You know, active guys, passive guys, we can both exist in the same universe.
I agree with that. Can I just throw something out at you for a second?
Sure.
Something that I've been kind of really wailing on for a while here. I agree that the concept, okay, you know, and by the way, I like index funds. We use that for certain strategies. There's no, you know, for certain areas that are very efficient. I think it's very good. You have active managers for other areas and sectors. You know, for example, I don't want an active manager, I don't want an index or a passive manager managing any fixed income I have. It's just not happening. Okay. Because I know that my active guys are always looking at the indexing side to poach really good deals when there has to be selling going on from the index guys. But my concern is the overabundance of indexing, and not only indexing and passive investing through ETFs by the individual investor, but now that we see a lot of hedgies taking on massive positions, my concern is this block trade of every stock. And my, for the last year, I've been talking about how it's gotten to a point that we're going to see volatility really kick up. So, okay, points to me. And because we're going to find that when things want to be moved out of, it's going to be, it's not done on a, okay, that stock, take out some of that stock, maybe add to that stock. It's this blanket, just sell, and everything just mm-hmm. goes. And then where are the bids? Where's the price
exactly.
discovery? And I have a real, seriously, I have a real problem with the amount of indexing and how it's being pushed and how it's taken on such an important position in portfolios. Just my two cents.
No, I think that there definitely is a concern about that. I don't know exactly how, you know, this could snowball. A couple of algorithms could, like, leave the humans behind. They can meet in a room and decide to screw us over. It's happened on you know, smaller scale. It absolutely could happen. It is something I'm concerned about. I'm not as familiar with the sort of the dynamics of how this could play itself out. But it is something, and also I think there could be a benefit for someone like me, and that maybe it draws of the attention uh-huh. away from the overlooked small caps and mid caps.
Right.
So you know.
And the other benefit for you also is that if you make in a bull market, or at least a non bear market, let's just say just a general market, right? That's just moving along, doing what it's supposed to do over time. The opportunity to be swept up with an index, in other words, when you have buying that goes on that lifts, you know, kind of all ships, it's beneficial
right.
to, you know, and it masks some of the crappy stocks. I'm not saying you pick crappy stocks. I'm just saying, generally speaking, if something maybe isn't doing as well for some reason, it kind of holds it up a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just, you know, and so there's kind of pros and cons. I'll give you that. We're running out of time. Any last things? First of all, I know that you can sign up for your newsletter and your alerts or your
yeah,
information pieces.
Yeah, I do a weekly newsletter, beloved by millions. So
millions,
you know, go to Crossing Wall Street. You can sign up for there. And you know, just want to say, if I could push humbly to say, you know, this ETF, I really think this is a very different product. I don't think there's anything like this on Wall Street. It's the very first ETF that has a fulcrum fee. So the fee, it changes by how well we do against our best benchmark, the S&P 500. It's the only, I think it's the only investment that was grew up on a blog that goes from blogging to actual real thing. My dad said it's good you never blogged about MMA, so I actually become a real one. And
Eddie, you know, the Crusher.
I know. I should not blog about that. Then you get in the ring. And it really is educational because you talk about being a, you know, instant professional investor, and then you become it, and there's a ticker symbol, and it's you, and you know, you have so many followers and great supporters who have bought into it, and it's just a great community, and it's now, you know, I didn't know if it would last a week, and it's been 18 months now.
That's great.
And it's done well for us, so we're really, really thrilled about it.
And of course, you can follow Eddie at Eddie Elfenbein. That's with two D's and a Y, but if you can't figure that out, we'll put it on the show notes for episode number 556 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And when it comes out, we'll tweet it. We'll cross-tweet and dot-tweet and, retweet the whole thing right back to Eddie. So, but might I tell you that, in all seriousness, he's got some, I don't know, you come up with some of the silly, stupid things, with all due respect, that you come up with, but they're kind of funny, you know?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anyway, Eddie, we'll talk soon. Thanks for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Thank you very much.
All right, great. Well, that was pretty cool. I enjoyed that. I hope you did too. Hope you got a little bit out of that, or a lot out of that, because there's some really good nuggets inside of, I think, what he talked about in terms of the understanding of fundamentals and looking at the individual stocks from a bottoms-up standpoint. When we talk about bottoms-up, by the way, that means a fundamental view of all of the earnings and information, the balance sheets and income statements, understanding ratios, looking at all of the components that make up the financials of a company. When you look at a top-down, a lot of times you look at that when somebody talks about a top-down, you're looking at the total of the economic impact of things. If you hear somebody say, well, interest rates are going up, therefore it's going to be good for banks, and that's how they invest, you think of that as a top-down manager. So bottoms up is one by one, looking at individual stocks and understanding the components that go into that for their financials. And a top-down is taking a broad-based view and looking at the markets from the aspect of maybe entire sectors, or maybe even equities versus fixed income. But looking at it from an economic viewpoint, or maybe even a regulatory viewpoint, saying that, well, there's going to be a really good amount of regulations related to the energy sector that's going to be very beneficial, for example. And you look at energy in total, and you say, I'm going to look at this, and then maybe pick some stocks from there, or pick the entire sector. So top down versus bottoms up. So Eddie is a bottoms up type of guy. So he's looking at individual stocks. So there's a lot to learn there. And I think a lot to really take notice of, that it can be done that way. And we know that there are other ways as well, but Eddie has really done a nice job. I really encourage you to check out his blog, the information that he provides, the ongoing commentary. You could sign up for his newsletter as well. All sorts of good things. And of course, check out his ETF. That's pretty cool. Other than that, I want to thank you for joining me again today. We'll see you again next week for some great guests that we have coming up. Make sure to be there. So with that, I'll see you next week. Have a great one.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.